We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft, is at the controls this morning. As part of the Illini Union's One Book, One Campus program, all incoming University of Illinois students this year received a copy of the book Acts of Faith by Eboo Patel. He's the founder of the Interfaith Youth Corps. And this is a Chicago-based international nonprofit that builds the interfaith youth movement. The hope is that by putting this book in the hands of new students, that will help to inspire many conversations across the campus about how it is that we deal with diversity. And the Illini Union has been doing this kind of thing, promoting the idea of One Book, One Campus now for a couple of years, and this was just the most recent example. This morning in this part of Focus 580, we'll talk with Eboo Patel about some of his experiences growing up as a Muslim, and also about the importance of religious pluralism. And he is someone certainly that in recent years has become increasingly known for promoting that idea and working toward that idea. He is a member of President Barack Obama's new Faith Advisory Council. He has a blog at the Washington Post where he blogs on these kinds of issues. It's called The Faith Divide. He serves on the Religious Advisory Committee of the Council on Foreign Relations. He is on, has been on the advisory board of Duke University Islamic Studies Center. He was named by U.S. News and World Report one of America's best leaders for 2009. He has a doctorate in sociology of religion from Oxford, where he studied on a Rhodes Scholarship, and he attended the University of Illinois here in Urbana-Champaign for his undergraduate studies. The book, by the way, if you would like to read it, his book, Acts of Faith, which is subtitled The Story of an American Muslim, The Struggle for the Soul of a Generation, is published by the Beacon Press. And certainly, I'm sure you can find it in the bookstore or library. And if you'd like to read it. And also, let me one more thing real quick mention that our guest, Eboo Patel, will be on the campus next week for a visit. He'll be taking a number of opportunities to speak with students, but one thing in particular you might like to know, there will be a free public lecture taking place in the Illini Union in rooms ABC, and there will be a reception, and this will be on Monday, 7 o'clock in the evening, and I'm sure anybody who is interested in attending should feel welcome. And of course, here on the program, questions and comments are welcome too. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, Dr. Patel, hello.
Hi there, David. It's great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Well, I'm glad you could be with us once again. We certainly do appreciate it.
My pleasure.
One sort of central idea here that I know that you spend a lot of time as you talk getting across is this. I think that, and I think it's fair to say, you correct me if I get this wrong, but that, you know, of all of the things now that exist that can divide people, of all of the things with the potential to divide us, and certainly there are plenty of things, it seems that religion, faith, has risen to the top of that list. Do you think that that is, in fact, the case?
I think that that's probably the case. I mean, I certainly think that the other lines of division are still powerful: race, class, gender, sexuality, ethnicity, nationality, the list goes on. But, W.E.B. Du Bois famously said 100 or so years ago that the problem of the 20th century would be the problem of the color line. There were certainly other problems in the 20th century, but the color line was probably the most prominent.
Yeah.
My sense is that the problem of the 21st century is going to be the problem of the faith line. I think it's probably the most pressing division we have to deal with today.
And I as you say, and I would not want to, I'm sure nobody would want to say that those other things, that conflicts across lines of gender, socioeconomic class, race, ethnicity, that those things don't exist. Of course, they do. But I suppose that some people would say, well, actually, on some of those things, maybe we've made a little bit of progress. Or maybe the thing is that for a variety of reasons, the intensity of conflict that has a religious dimension has increased.
I would generally agree with that. The other thing is, I think that whether or not we've made a ton of progress on those other issues, there is a vibrant, robust discourse on them, mm-hmm. and the path forward has been illuminated, even if we haven't run down all of those paths. I think the particular challenge around the faith line is a lot of people feel they don't even have the tools to deal with it. Mm-hmm. There isn't enough of a discourse about the story we see on the evening news every night, which is, you know, somebody killing somebody else to the soundtrack of prayer. It feels inevitable. It feels overwhelming. And part of what we're about at the Interfaith Youth Core is offering illumination and a set of tools to help address those problems.
I have been very struck by some things you've said, talking, for example, about the time that you were here at the University of Illinois, were an undergraduate, and about how people would get together and they talk about all kinds of things. They talk about their differences. They talk about the idea of diversity. They talk about what kind of world they'd like to see and how they might work toward that. And at the same time, that there was little or no discussion of religion. It just seemed to be something that people were, and I don't know if it was that they were hesitant to talk about it or didn't exactly know how to talk about it.
Right. Well, I was at the University of Illinois from 1993 to 1996. It was a very exciting period to be a college student. It was in some ways the height of the multiculturalism movement, or at least one dimension of that movement. The terrible Rodney King incident and riots had recently happened. And I think campuses were responding to that and other high-profile incidents of racial tension, division, and violence by transforming how campuses dealt with diversity issues. This was the era in which Harvard University launched an Afro-American Studies department. Cornel West's Race Matters had come out and was being read literally everywhere. Bell Hooks was a very prominently read intellectual at the time. We talked all the time about issues of race, ethnicity, class, gender, and at that time sexuality was just coming on the radar screen. But I think I can probably remember in my 3 years as an undergraduate at the University of Illinois the topic of religion coming up maybe 5 times. Mm. And my dad pointed out at one point, you know, Ibu, you talk about diversity all the time, but you're missing the dimension of diversity that's driving world politics right now, and that's religious diversity. And again, during that same period, 93 to 96, that was right after the first Gulf War, that was the Balkans War, Yitzhak Rabin, the Israeli prime minister, was murdered during that period by an extremist from his own faith. The Atlanta Olympics were bombed by an extremist who called himself a Christian. The World Trade Center was bombed by extremists who called themselves Muslims. So the issue of religious diversity was prominent in the culture. It was just absent from the diversity discussion on college campuses.
Well, and that, maybe we can talk in a moment about whether you think that that has started to change. And I think that the organization that you founded, that's part of the goal, is to teach people how to have those conversations or to go out and start those conversations. But just to go back to this basic question of why it is that people weren't talking about it and maybe still aren't, does that have something to do with maybe a basic hesitancy to talk about religion and faith at all? That's just one of those sort of things that you're not supposed to talk about. Or is it something more than that?
Right. So my PhD is in the sociology of religion, and I spent a good bit of time looking at this question, and I think that the answers are complex and layered. So I'll offer a handful of them. One is the best sociologists of the 1960s, guys like Peter Berger and others, were saying that faith was dead. Harvey Cox at Harvard University wrote a well-known book called The Secular City. The beginning line of that book was, "The rise of urban civilization and the demise of traditional religion are the two main hallmarks of our time, and they're closely linked." And of course, the academy takes its scholars seriously. And so I think that many that of of all the institutions in American culture in the late 20th century who continued to believe that religion was dead, the academy was one of those institutions, and perhaps the leading one to believe that religion was simply going to fade from the earth. I think that this, and so it made it difficult to take seriously conversations about religion when you think it's something is going to disappear. I think a second reason is because people lacked the tools and the comfort to talk about issues of religious identity and religious diversity, and people would say to me and still say to me, you know, this is just too hard. And my response is, as if talking about race isn't hard or sexuality isn't hard, the fact is we do things that are hard because they're worth doing, no matter how long they take, no matter how uncomfortable they make us. And if we forfeit the discussion of religion to people who would build barriers between folks from different faiths or bombs between people of different faiths, then we lose. It's that simple. So I think it's worth it to have the hard conversation about religion and learn ways to bring people from different faith backgrounds together. I want to add one thing to this, David, which is my guess is that the largest student groups on many college campuses after fraternities and sororities are religious groups. InterVarsity Christian Fellowship is probably the largest amongst them. And so, I mean, frankly, I think that the academy just missed something that was not only bright in the culture in terms of issues of religious diversity, but also right under its nose in terms of prominence of religious groups.
Let me introduce again our guest for this part of Focus 580, Eboo Patel. He's the founder and the executive director of the Interfaith Youth Corps. This is a Chicago-based international nonprofit building the interfaith youth movement. He's the author of a book that it's in part about his experiences growing up and about the importance of interfaith dialogue. The title of his book is Acts of Faith, The Story of an American Muslim, The Struggle for the Soul of a Generation. It's published by the Beacon Press, and it is the book that was given out this year by the Illini Union as part of their One Campus, One Book program, something that's now been going out for a number of years. All of the new incoming students to the University of Illinois got a copy of this, and the idea very clearly is to get people to read the books and then to talk about the issues, and they've been doing this for a number of years, and by the way, for people who are on the campus or around the campus, now they're soliciting people's suggestions for the book, the One Book, One Campus book for next year, for 2010-2011. So if you'd like to put in your suggestion, you can go to the Illini Union website and you can do that. Also, our guest Eboo Patel will be here spending time talking with students next week. He'll be here Monday, Tuesday, and you might want to stop by and hear him. He'll be giving a free public lecture in the Illini Union on Monday night, 7 o'clock, in rooms ABC. Also, of course, you can go out to the bookstore, and I'm sure, and find his book. Questions, comments, welcome. People want to be involved in the conversation, you can do that, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. I think that it is common for people, as maybe they're growing up or as they live their lives, for a lot of people don't stray from their neighborhood, and I guess I mean that both in a literal and figurative way. And that probably a lot of people live in neighborhoods where, you know, everybody's like them. They maybe would have to make a deliberate opportunity to spend time with people who came from a different background or came from a different faith. And one of the things I was really struck by in reading the story you tell about your growing up is that your parents, I think, you were raised Muslim, but they seemed to think that it was a very important thing for you to know about other faiths, what other people believed, and to have some contact with people who came out of different faith backgrounds. Why do you think that was something that for them was important?
So there's a personal dimension to this story, which is, you know, my parents grew up as Muslims in Bombay, India. And there is a dimension of India which is religious communities in tension and violence with each other. And there's another much larger dimension, which is religious communities in peaceful coexistence and cooperation with each other. And that's the dimension of India my parents grew up in. And so grew up with friends who were Hindus and Sikhs and Jains and Christians and secular humanists and other Muslims. And They wanted that for their kids. They wanted, you know, us to, as some folks say, have roots in our own religion, but to live in a house with the winds that were open and to recognize that other religions existed. And while we did not believe those same things, we respected people of those faiths. My best friends in high school included a Cuban Jew, a Nigerian evangelical, a South Indian Hindu, a Mormon, a Lutheran, and a Catholic. And I have to tell you something, David. I frankly think that that's much more the norm now, that people grow up with people from different religions. What is not the norm yet is the ability to have positive conversations about religion with people from different religions. Too often folks think that the only kind of conversation you can have with somebody from a different religion is the conversation of conversion. Let me begin by saying about this that I think conversion, or seeking to convert somebody else, is perfectly legitimate. It's a part of my faith, Islam. It's a big part of Christianity. It's a part of other faiths such as Buddhism. I think it's protected by religious freedom. But I don't think it's the only conversation that people from different religions can have. And what we want to do at the Interfaith Youth Corps is articulate the common ground that different faiths have that they can cooperate on. And for us, that's all about the shared values of service between different religions. How does Islam, Christianity, Judaism, Hinduism, etc., speak to the concept of mercy? Speak to the concept of compassion, of generosity, and how can we gather together on that common ground and work for those ends collectively?
Yeah. Well, you're arguing very strongly, and when you talk about what needs to happen if people are going to come together this way, that what it takes is a way of looking at diversity in looking at people who come from different backgrounds or people who practice different faiths, and starting out by saying, what do we have in common? And then so there are sort of two ways you can do that, or it seems that there are also people in the world who would, you know, they're not interested in commonality, and maybe they're not going to believe that there is. You know, what
right.
really makes the difference between either starting out by saying, man, there's no getting us together, and on the one hand, and on the other hand saying, well, wait a minute, there, if you look at what we really believe is important, it looks like it's actually the same. We believe in the same things there.
Well, important. David, I want to nuance that a little bit.
Yeah.
I think that there is tremendous commonality between different religions. I also think that there are very, very important differences. And so at the Interfaith Youth Corps, we just had our sixth conference on interfaith youth cooperation. 600-plus people from 12 different countries and 90 different campuses in America represented. And what was powerful about the conference for me was people saying things like, I am here because I'm a Muslim. The path of Islam leads to a conference on interfaith cooperation. I'm here because I'm an evangelical Christian. And I encounter people from different religions every day. And sure, I wish that they were Christian. But I am also taught in the Bible that whatever faith they're from, they were created in the image of God, and I am meant to treat them as my neighbor. So at the Interfaith Youth Corps, the last thing we do is subordinate difference. What we also seek to do is to say, look, whatever differences we have, and however important those differences are, there are also huge swaths of common ground, particularly on these shared social values of compassion, of mercy, of charity, of service, of justice. And as we raise up that commonality, we raise up with it the issue of particularity. And particularity, I'm nuancing from difference in this way. Muslims have a particular path to the shared value of mercy. We have in our Holy Scripture, the Quran, we have in the example of the Prophet Muhammad, may the peace and blessings of God be upon him. We have unique examples. Now, Christians also have unique examples in the Bible, in the example of Jesus, in the example of the Desert Fathers. What we would like to do at the Interfaith Youth Corps is to say, let's stand on that common ground together, but let's tell the stories of how our particularity from Islam, from Judaism, from Buddhism, from the Baha'i faith brings us to this common ground. And then most importantly, let's find ways to act together to bring the values of compassion, of mercy, of service into the world in concrete ways. So that's the model of the organization. I call it a model of articulating particularity and achieving pluralism while recognizing differences that we're frankly never going to agree on.
So it's about, in short, it's about more than just getting people to know one another and to talk to each other, but it's getting people involved in some sort of common project that is taking some sort of action that is a reflection that we say, well, here, this is a reflection of our common view. So let's not talk about it. Let's go do something.
We have a ton of materials and resources and images for this on our website at ifyc.org. So I'd love for your audience to check out that website, ifyc.org, download our guides for this, check out the stories of people who are leading interfaith service projects. These are some inspiring young people.
Do you think that college campuses are a particularly good place for the development of the interfaith movement?
Absolutely. And in fact, a huge part of the Interfaith Youth Corps' focus is working with higher education to help campuses become models of interfaith cooperation. During the time I was on campus, college campuses were becoming models of multiculturalism, and they were becoming models of service learning. So, you know, in 1993, the service learning movement was just taking off, and a certain percentage of the campus at the University of Illinois was volunteering. But the administration invested in volunteer programs, and now I would bet you that percentage of students has gone up 50%, maybe even doubled. We think campuses should be models of interfaith cooperation. We actually have a set of hallmarks that we hope campuses can look to and achieve. These hallmarks include things like no statement of religious prejudice on a college campus should go unchallenged. Racial prejudice is challenged. Gender bias is challenged. Religious prejudice is still too prevalent. We think it should be challenged all the time, and we think that university leaders should take pride that their campus is a place where, you know, people can't say things like, you know, Barack Obama's Muslim grandfather effectively disqualifies him from running for president. We also think college campuses should be places where a critical mass of students are engaging in positive interfaith activity like interfaith service projects. We think college campuses should be places where there is consistent, prominent public programming on issues of interfaith cooperation. I'm proud to be a part of that at the university next week. College campuses should be places where student leaders and staff, faculty, and administration are trained on issues of religious diversity. And David, I think back to my own training at the University of Illinois when I was a resident advisor and campus leader in other ways. A good half of my training focused on issues of race, class, ethnic, gender diversity, almost zero on issues of religious diversity. I think every RA at every college campus in America should have some significant training on religious diversity. I mean, college campuses are places that bring America's great diversity together. We're the most religiously diverse nation in human history. I think RAs and freshman orientation leaders should have some fluency in that diversity and should view it as a way to build bridges instead of barriers.
Let me just take a moment here to reintroduce our guest, Eboo Patel. He is the author of the book Acts of Faith, The Story of an American Muslim, The Struggle for the Soul of a Generation. He is the founder, executive director of the Interfaith Youth Corps. This is a Chicago-based international nonprofit that works to build the interfaith youth movement. The book, Acts of Faith, which is published by the Beacon Press, was the book that was given out to all incoming U of I students this year as a part of the Illini Union's One Book, One Campus program. And the idea is not that they're going to be tested on this, but the hope is that people will read it and that will give them something to think about and also to talk about as they get together and meet new people and start their career here at the University of Illinois. Let me tell you just a little bit more about him. He is a sociologist by his academic training. He has a doctorate in sociology of religion from Oxford University, where he studied on a Rhodes Scholarship. And as he mentioned, he was an undergraduate here at the University of Illinois. He is a member of President Barack Obama's new Faith Advisory Council. He was named one of America's best leaders for 2009. by U.S. News and World Report. He's on the Religious Advisory Committee of the Council on Foreign Relations and has served on the advisory board of Duke University's Islamic Studies Center. He has a blog. It's based at the Washington Post. It's The Faith Divide, which explores issues of faith and what brings people together and what drives them apart. Questions here are certainly welcome. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. And let me just mention one more time, he'll be here on the campus of the university next week. He'll certainly be spending a lot of time talking with students. He will also give a free public lecture at the Illini Union Monday night at 7. So anybody who would like to hear him should feel welcome to stop by. And, of course, again, questions, comments, welcome. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. I think that, it's easy to say that at least at some point you're going to try to concentrate on shared values and then try to do something that involves acting on shared values. I guess what I wonder is how it is you think, though, about the differences and when you have people of different faiths getting together and talking about who they are and trying to get to know one another, what you do with the differences, because as you say, there are differences there.
I think you learn from each other's differences. And let me give you a fantastic example of this, which just took place at the Interfaith Youth Core Conference. My friend Rabbi Orr Rose was on a panel with my friend Sky Jathani. And Sky is the editor of Leadership Magazine, which is part of the Christianity Today family of magazines, which is an evangelical family of magazines widely read in the mainline evangelical community. And Orr turned to Sky and said, you know, I reject the notion of Jesus as the Son of God and as, in fact, God on earth in the way that Christians view Jesus. But I find in that illustration a powerful idea about the immanence of the divine. So while I reject the particular theology, which is, you know, frankly, a central tenet of the Christian faith, I still learn from it. And I think that's it takes deep fluency in one's own faith tradition, and it also takes comfort with the fact of difference to be able to come to a theological breakthrough like that. So, I mean, what are you going to do with things that are theologically incompatible except for acknowledge them, disagree about them, and then learn from them? I mean, that's the deal. We live in a world of great diversity and deep difference. The Holy Quran tells Muslims that God made us different nations and tribes, that we may come to know one another. That doesn't mean I agree with people on everything, but disagreeing with them on very important things also doesn't mean that I have to be in conflict with them.
Different faiths, I think it's correct to say different faiths place different degrees of importance on evangelizing.
Right.
I think to one degree or another, I think probably everyone would think that was somewhat important, although some place more importance on it than others.
Right.
And I wonder what you think about that, particularly if there someone, you know, you do have a faith where there's this very strong injunction that says it's your responsibility, your duty, your obligation to go out and tell other people and not just to inform them, but the ultimate goal really is to convert them.
Sure. Well, I have... Let me take evangelical Christianity, which is a tradition that I have learned a great deal about in the last 6 years, and I have tremendous admiration for and also deep differences with. So I count amongst my friends people like the Reverend Rick Warren, Reverend Bill Hybels, Reverend Bob Roberts, Reverend Jim Wallace. These are people that I am in some frequent contact with. Most of our conversations are about how our different faiths inspire us to improve the world together. Now, I know all of these people wish that I were a Christian. Some of them have invited me to reconsider Christ as the Son of God and as the way, the truth, and the life. I respect their belief that they have a command to do so. I listen respectfully to that. I tell them that I don't agree with that and that I am going to continue in my own tradition, which views Jesus reverently as a prophet of God. But I think they have every right to respectfully invite others into their faith. What I hope is that they don't believe that's the only conversation we can have. Mm-hmm. And in my entire career doing interfaith work, 12 years of this, and in the last 6 years of doing it very deeply with evangelical Christians, and having met many of them at the University of Illinois, including one remarkable young man named Nick Price, who is an InterVarsity leader at the University of Illinois and is currently an InterVarsity staff member at UIC, I find it very much the case that we can have different kinds of conversations about religion. A small part of the conversation is a conversation about conversion, and a large part is a conversation about cooperation. And let me tell you what I think the theology behind this is, that every sentence of every page of the Bible does not say, convert other people to your faith. Certainly, evangelical Christians would say that is a high requirement, but it is not the only requirement. And so when I speak with Nick Price, for example, he says, look, the Bible says blessed are the peacemakers. And if a lot of strife is between different religions, then I have to learn how to build bridges between different religions, even as I pray in the name of Jesus Christ and Lord as Lord and Savior, and seek to invite other people into that understanding. So, you know, F. Scott Fitzgerald once famously said that the mark of an intelligent person is to be able to hold two seemingly contradictory ideas in one's head at the same time and continue to function. I mean, that's how all of us live all the time in this wonderfully contradictory world, and I view that as very much a part of what we're doing at the Interfaith Youth Corps.
All right, let's talk with someone here, a caller in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Hello. Is it true that Muslims regard dogs as unclean?
You know, I don't believe that's true. I mean, there's 1.3 billion Muslims on the planet, and there are a wide variety of interpretations, and one interpretation is that a dog's saliva makes a Muslim's prayer, means a Muslim would have to wash specially and pray again if a dog's saliva was near them during praying. But broadly speaking, dogs are part of God's creation, and there's actually a number of really powerful stories about the Prophet Muhammad's merciful treatment of dogs. And I'll give you just one quick one, which is inspiring to me. When the Prophet was leading a caravan of his companions from Medina to Mecca, he looked ahead on the road and he saw a litter of pups. And he required the caravan to go around the pups so that they wouldn't be crushed. And so I view that as, you know, the Prophet's love and respect for dogs, as he loved and respected all of human creation.
All right. Hope that gets to the question of the caller. Others are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Our guest is Eboo Patel. He's the founder, executive director of the Interfaith Youth Corps. It's a Chicago-based international nonprofit organization that builds interfaith connections between young people. And his book is Acts of Faith, The Story of an American Muslim, The Struggle for the Soul of a Generation. And that book is published by the Beacon Press. And as I mentioned here a couple times, he'll be on the campus next week. We'll be talking with students, and we'll also be giving a free talk Monday evening at 7 at the Illini Union. So when people are interested, they can hear him. And of course, if you'd like to read the story, which is a lot about his own experiences growing up, the book is out and has been out for a little while now, and I'm sure you can find it in the library or the bookstore. And certainly comments, questions are welcome. 3-3.
And I do want to say that there's a whole chapter in the book about my time at the University of Illinois, and it's and the prospect of returning and the capacity of being the author of the One Book, One Illinois program is mm-hmm. is an honor that I could never imagine, and it's one of the things that I carry in my heart as a great blessing. So I am rereading that particular chapter of the book in my memories of being on a campus that had a dramatic impact on me from when I was there. And I think so fondly about my mentors at that campus, folks like Howie Schein at Unit 1, Bruce Michelson at the Campus Honors Program, a lot of folks in the administration, certainly a dozen plus members of the faculty, and it warms my heart to be able to come back, relive some of those memories, and articulate how the University of Illinois was a launching pad and an inspiration for the kind of work I'm doing now.
Yeah. Maybe you could talk a little bit more about how it is the Interfaith Youth Corps came to be.
Sure. Well, you know, one of the things that happened to me at the University of Illinois is I was introduced to the Catholic Worker Movement through St. Jude's Catholic Worker House, which is in Champaign, and I, you know, pray to God that it's still there. And it was my first introduction to faith and service, or my first introduction in as kind of a young man. And what basically happened was I was thinking to my, you know, I had this kind of set of different thoughts in my head as I was going to volunteer at the St. Jude's Catholic Worker House. One set of thoughts was every time I see religion on TV, it's somebody killing somebody else to the soundtrack of prayer. The second thought was religion is entirely absent from the diversity discussion on college campuses. The third thought is there's this powerful tradition of faith connecting to service. And at some point, those things just kind of came together in my head. And I thought to myself, well, wait a second. If all religious traditions inspire service, and I knew mine did as a Muslim, and I was learning that the Catholic tradition did, and I was reading in the Jewish and Buddhist and Hindu traditions about their theologies of service, and there is a big problem in the world of religious conflict, why aren't we bringing people from different religions together to serve others? Why can't we use service as the common ground for cooperation? That was the big idea, which is, I mean, a very simple idea, frankly, right? And the notion of the Interfaith Youth Corps is that we are going to be in a movement-building institution. And primarily what we are going to do is advance the idea that people from different religions should be cooperating with each other on service rather than battling with each other on doctrinal difference. The second thing that we do is we work very closely with college campuses to help them become models of interfaith cooperation. The third thing that we do is we train and network a generation of interfaith leaders, people who come from college campuses and say, just like human rights activists or environmentalists or civil rights activists, we want to be the generation who has the skill set and the knowledge base to bring people from different faiths together on service projects. That's what we do. And, you know, the idea hit me in 1998. I went off to Oxford for my Rhodes Scholarship. I ran interfaith service projects for a couple years in different parts of the world, from Sri Lanka to India to South Africa. We got our first grant from the Ford Foundation in the summer of 2002 for $35,000. We are currently a $4 million organization with a presence on six continents and a staff of 30 people. So it's been good growth over the past couple of years, but we view this being a global movement that truly penetrates the culture. And my hope is that interfaith cooperation becomes a social norm in the course of the next generation. Just as environmental consciousness has become a social norm, just as women's rights have become a social norm, we want interfaith cooperation to become a social norm, and we believe that American college campuses and a generation of young leaders are the way to accomplish that.
Mm-hmm. I think you make an important point about people's attitudes toward their own faith and what it means to practice that, and how they think about people of other faiths. These sorts of things, it's not something you're born with. It's something that you're taught.
And that's exactly right. And you know, David, I want to just interject something there, which is that people also aren't born with religious hate. People are taught religious hate. The reason I want to emphasize that is to point out that there are huge movements that are teaching religious hate, that are pointing out places in different religious traditions that emphasizing the small dimensions of those traditions which teach that differences are meant to divide. And if we don't have a movement that is teaching the opposite, which is that there's common ground between different faiths and that we are meant to cooperate and we have to learn to live with the differences, between these faiths, then we let those other people win. And I really think that college campuses and young leaders is the best way to address this. I mean, the multicultural movement started on college campuses and became a norm in the broader culture. I think the same thing can happen with the interfaith movement.
Yeah.
And I think that people can do it immediately. And here's how they can do it. People can change the conversation about religion. You can do it an hour from now. You can stand up to religious prejudice. I mean, I think about the whole Barack Obama is a Muslim whisper campaign and the Mitt Romney is a Mormon campaign. I mean, in what world did we in America allow that kind of religious bias to be acceptable in the culture? I mean, if somebody had said, you know, Barack Obama is from Hawaii and his mom is from Kansas and that should disqualify him from running for president, we'd have been up in arms, right? I mean, because that's ridiculous. That's just straight-out prejudice. Why does it matter that his grandfather was a Muslim? Why does it matter that Mitt Romney was a Mormon? I think we need to stand up against religious prejudice, and in the same way that we stand up against racial prejudice and gender bias. There's a couple other ways we can change the conversation about religion. One of those ways is you can learn something positive about somebody else's faith. You can learn about mercy as a central value in Islam. You can learn about tikkun olam, repairing the world, as a central tenet in Judaism. You can learn about Jesus as reaching out to the least of these in Christianity. These are things that all of us can admire. I think a third thing is to learn what it is in your own faith or tradition, from Islam to secular humanism, that would inspire you to cooperate with others. And when I ask these questions on college campuses, people don't know the answers to them. They don't know what it is in their religion that would inspire them to cooperate with others. They can't name something admirable about another religion. I just think that that's a chasm of ignorance that is currently being filled by people who are invested in building barriers. And if we don't have a movement that is advancing the idea that there are admirable things in other faiths, that there are dimensions of your own faith which inspire cooperation, effectively, we forfeit a generation to people who would build barriers or bombs.
Let's talk with some others. Champagne is the next in line. Line one. Hello.
Hi. I'm really enjoying your program, and I'm really glad you're speaking on this topic. It's a generation ago, I was involved in the ecumenical movement. Well, I was in college, so that was on the University of Michigan campus, except at that time, it was perceived as Protestant Catholic Jew. There was a very famous, there was a book written by that title.
Right, Will Herberg in 1955,
okay.
Protestant Catholic Jew.
And now I think it would be Christian Jew Muslim.
Well, you know, I appreciate that comment. I do want to point something out, that America has maybe 4 million Buddhists, maybe a million Hindus, a million plus Hindus. I promise you the University of Illinois has significant Hindu, Sikh, Jain, Buddhist, secular humanist populations. And so I don't think we're an Abrahamic country. I think we are a religiously diverse country. And I think that we need to engage the full diversity of those religions, Native American traditions, et cetera. In fact, Harvard scholar Diana Eck says America is the most religiously diverse country in human history. So that's one of the reasons I like the shared values approach to interfaith cooperation, because all faith communities and secular humanist traditions would value positive social approaches like service, compassion, justice, et cetera.
Yeah, I don't think that the Jains, the Sikhs, the Hindus are as discriminated against at this point as the Muslims, because the Muslims are associated with 9/11, all the terrorists are supposed to be Muslims. I mean, that's a big myth. And I see that the Muslims, my perception is that the Muslims are in the same kind of position that the Jews were 50 years ago or more. But, yes, I ran an after-school program that used service learning, and we had a Sikh, we had at least one Hindu, we had Korean Christians, a lot of it, we had an Indian Catholic, and But at any rate, when I was part of this ecumenical movement, I was in a community, a study community, not a living community, for a year during college. It was called Covenant Community. And we were all Protestants, but the year before it had an Orthodox, Christian Orthodox. But we had Mass at the local Catholic church on Saturday mornings, and those of us who weren't Catholic could not take communion. But, of course, then we went down to the church basement and had breakfast, and as far as I'm concerned, the real communion took place there. But as far as questions of, Barack Obama with his Muslim heritage in 1960 when Kennedy ran for president, then the big question was, can a Catholic be president?
Right, and I just want to say, in my view, I think Muslims are kind of at the center of the prejudice radar screen right now, but I don't want anybody to be discriminated against. And so I'm not working for Muslims only to not be discriminated against. I'm working for America to achieve its ideal of interfaith cooperation and religious pluralism. So, and we're not becoming any less religiously diverse. So I think that we need to address the ideal of interfaith cooperation, seek to build that, and we need to put an end to religious discrimination of any sort.
Yeah, I'm not disagreeing with you.
Right. Thanks. I appreciate your comments.
I'm a Quaker, and I grew up Methodist, and I became a Quaker. And the Quakers had a long history when they first came to this country of peaceful negotiations with the Native Americans. And there are stories of when the Native Americans went on a massacre, they passed over the Quaker homes because they had been treated well by the Quakers. So, yeah, absolutely. I mean, being a Buddhist or being a Muslim 50 years ago or 100 years ago was hardly viable in this country. Now it's very viable. And being a Buddhist, there was a big argument about whether the Buddhists could, the Hindus could build a temple at a, and we got some NIMBY stuff, not in my backyard. So I do see the society becoming more and more diverse, and I think that's a good thing. So I really welcome the work that you're doing.
Thank you so much. I hope you and your audience check us out at www.ifyc.org.
Let's see if we can get at least one more caller here. We have a couple. We'll go next in line to someone in Effingham on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Does your nuance, that's what I would call it, in religion and humanity, and the contradictions of the capitalist state, the discrimination that evolves, how that could be resolved? I don't think there can be a benign capitalism. And the other thing is, last time I called about religion, I talked to Martin Marty from Chicago, and patriarchy is God as a male. How did that happen? And its connotation of male dominance.
And I can give you about 2 minutes, Ibu.
Right.
That's a lot, I know.
Well, I'm not a theologian. I am a believing Muslim, and I believe God is beyond. So as far as gender and God, I just pray to a compassionate God. As far as capitalism, I want a world in which people live in full dignity, in which they're free, in which they are healthy, and I want to make whatever system that we are a part of as humane as possible. I will say that in Islam, Muhammad was a merchant, and he was a well-respected merchant whose nickname was Al-Amin, the reliable. And in Islam, markets are central to the tradition, meaning that we view the world as a in Islam, matters of the world are very important, not just matters of the cosmos. And central to how we view a just world is the ability to to have and participate freely and fully in markets. I think that that's one of the places that Muhammad Yunus, the great Bangladeshi Muslim who founded the microfinance movement, viewed his initial work as giving poor villagers in Bangladesh the opportunity to participate as full human beings in the market by being able to create their own products and to sell them on the open market. So I'm not an economist. I would like to live in as humane a world as possible, and I think it can be certainly more humane than it is.
We are at the point where we have to finish, and I guess just one thing that really strikes me, and you mentioned it, the fact that not only do we talk a lot about the United States being a very religious country, where people say that they do believe, but that the level of religious diversity here probably greater than any other country
right.
in the world.
I say that America is the most religiously diverse nation in human history, the most religiously devout nation in the West at a time of global religious conflict. And I believe that we can be a model of interfaith cooperation. And in order for that to happen, we need higher education to step up as an institution, and we need a generation of young people who call themselves interfaith leaders. And I can't wait to bring that message to campus back to my home in person next Monday and Tuesday.
All right. Our guest, Eboo Patel. If you'd like to read more about him, some of his thoughts, you can look for his book, Acts of Faith. It is published by the Beacon Press. He is the founder and executive director of the Interfaith Youth Corps, a Chicago-based international nonprofit building the interfaith youth movement. And indeed, they have a website. Just go to ifyc.org.
That's you can right. find out more.
Ifyc.org. And you can look for the book, and he'll be here next week. And again, he'll talk Monday night, 7 o'clock at the Illini Union. So anybody who's interested should stop by. Thanks very much.